From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our interesting callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, fish oil. Does it really do anything? Is it worth swallowing those capsules? What's the research about it?
I think from the tone of your voice, I know what you're...
Well, we'll see.
What else?
Stay tuned. And doctors, should we prescribe medications for people who are, quote, tired of living? Not with a terminal disease, tired of living.
You mean,
should we prescribe it so that they can end their life?
Okay.
I mean, talk about controversy.
Yeah.
That certainly raises controversy, certainly in my mind and in the mind of probably most other people.
Of course. What's our recipe?
Perry's Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo.
Looking forward to this one. This coming from a listener named Perry, and it's coming up in about, 25 minutes or so. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, let's welcome our first caller, a listener with us in Maryville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question. I have just a single hiccup occasionally, and it's usually like only once in a day. I may go 2 or 3 days or a week without having one, or I may have one a couple of days in a row, or maybe even rarely twice in a day. And it just catches me by surprise, and it's a real strong hiccup, but I only have the one. My wife fusses at me. She's decided that it's a burp. I can tell the difference in the way it feels. It's definitely a hiccup.
When does this happen? Morning, afternoon, evening?
No particular time. I've not been able to tie it to anything. It's been going on for probably forever, and I just never paid any attention to it until my wife started fussing about it. So I Googled it just to see. I was going to pull up a page, you know, and show her that lots of people have these random hiccups. And what I found surprised me. Most of the links that I hit where they were talking about it, it was women who had it. And the first time they ever started having them was during a pregnancy.
Well, first of all, we pretty much can tell the difference, most of us, between a hiccup and a burp.
Yeah.
So it probably is not that. But this is an irritation of the diaphragm usually, and it's an irritation of the nerve that feeds the diaphragm. And babies get it all the time, of course. We see little babies and they hiccup, and we always think it's funny because, you know, the funny faces that they make when they do it. And then there are other things that cause hiccups. For instance, you know, traditionally in movies, when people look like they're drunk, they hiccup a lot. It's sort of part of that. Part of the way that they look, and that's because when we have an irritation to the diaphragm, often it will produce it, hot, spicy food for some people. So you've just got something that is randomly producing an irritation of the diaphragm, and frankly, nothing is going to get rid of it. We have pills that we used to use for people with hiccups that we can't stop, and basically they were tranquilizers, phenothiazine tranquilizers that would stop the hiccup. But that's for people with chronic hiccups where it interferes with their life. So the answer is irritation of the diaphragm for some reason, probably coming from the gut. And the treatment is to tell your wife that you love her, and it will just continue as part of your life.
Life.
I can tell this has been a topic of conversation between you.
Oh, yeah. If you sided with me and said, you know, some reason or whatever, this would only call your medical expertise into doubt.
Foregone conclusion. Thank you so much for your call.
We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Toll-free, of course. 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Cambridge, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Hello. I was diagnosed with diverticulitis after having some pretty intense pain for about a year. And they did a scan and they found it. And I have it in my transverse colon, which isn't where people normally have it. And people my age don't normally have diverticulitis. And I'm just wondering if there's any insight you guys could provide as to how to avoid future flare-ups. There's all sorts of conflicting information out there about seeds and nuts and things you can't eat and things you can't eat and whether it was caused by good diet or bad diet. I just wanted to hear what you had to say.
So first of all, what are diverticulitis? Well, why did you have the colonoscopy in the first place or the imaging testing?
Because I really was in a lot of pain and it was in a weird spot. It was on the upper right, and so they couldn't determine what was causing it.
Okay. So first of all, diverticulosis, which are pockets in the colon, are actually very common. And diverticulitis, the inflammation, is not an uncommon thing at all, more common in the 40s than in the 30s. We know that people who have high fiber diets are less likely to get it. So in other words, people who don't eat refined foods, as we in America eat, tend not to have diverticulosis. We also know that the Brits, the English, are very susceptible, and it has to do with the fact that they eat lots of refined foods. The bigger the bulk on your stool, the bulkier your stool, the better off things are. And why is that? Frankly, we don't really know. There's some people who say it sort of cleans out the pockets. But, you know, I think that's just our, you know, just kind of what we call the rectospectoscope. We look backwards and we say, well, that's what it's from. But it's not. We know that fiber is good when you have it. Now, foods to avoid, forget it. It's garbage. It's junk. It's not true. We used to say if you have diverticulosis or diverticulitis, don't eat popcorn because popcorn, the kernels will get stuck in it. Don't eat seeds and nuts. It turns out that's an old doctor's tale. There's absolutely 100% no proof that nuts and seeds get caught. I mean, there must have been one surgeon back in the day who opened up somebody with severe diverticulitis and found a popcorn kernel, and then it spread like wildfire as a rumor. But it is a medical myth that you have to make any changes in your diet, except you should eat a high-fiber diet. We know that if you eat fiber, that reduces the risk you're going to have an inflammation of the colon. So don't avoid anything. Just eat some, you know, bran, or you can take Metamucil. Metamucil is a very easy way to get a lot of fiber in your diet. A scoop or two of Metamucil is equal to about four or five bowls of bran cereal in terms of soluble fiber. And it doesn't matter if it's soluble or insoluble. It's just fiber, whole wheat, whole grains, and a good fiber-filled breakfast in the morning. Does that answer things?
It does. I feel challenged because I actually do eat a lot of fiber. I've lost about 95 pounds over the last 5 years and kept off.
Congratulations. But how about when you were younger? How about when you were younger? Did you eat a lot of...
Oh, no. Mom's idea of dinner was fish sticks, right?
Was fish sticks. Okay. So this is from your past. You may never get another inflammation of diverticulitis. There are a lot of people who have one and none, one and gone. So I have patients who've had one episode and they never get another episode again because they change their diet. You know. And as for fish sticks, probably a few months ago when I was in the grocery store, I said, I think I'm just going to try fish sticks. You know, I just want to taste it to see what they are like. And when I was all done eating my first fish stick. You know what I decided?
Forget it. I can't think of anything less desirable to eat than a fish on a stick.
We used to hide them. We would keep the pot holders on the table from carrying out the hot tray, and my sisters and I would tuck them inside the pot holder.
Makes sense to me.
So Keep up the good work in terms of fiber, and congratulations on the weight loss. Whatever you are doing, package it and sell it, and you will make $1 billion.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thanks. You so much. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, a study on fish oil for the heart.
Yes. Okay. So talk about a controversy. Whenever I talk about fish oil, unless I am pro fish oil, I just get nasty emails and how can you do this? How can you say this? So let's talk about where fish oil came from. Let's talk about why we even think about having fish oil. So back in the 60s, we never heard of fish oil. In the 70s, we never heard of fish oil. In the 80s, we started to hear about fish oil. In the 90s, it became a $1 billion-a-year industry. And it was because of EPA and DHA, which are the two oils in fish oil. We found that people who eat fatty fish, they had less heart disease, less stroke, couple of servings of fish a week appears to be the answer. If you don't eat fish and you like fish, start to put fish in your diet. So then, because we industrialize and medicalize everything, instead of saying, let's eat fish, we decided to make a capsule. And when I don't say we, I don't mean me. I mean as our society.
Yeah.
And so people stepped up. And then we looked at what should be in the capsules, and now people have 1,000 to 3,000 milligrams of fish oil, one, two or three times a day. And it changes the numbers. It improves the cholesterol. It may increase the good cholesterol, and it decreases the bad cholesterol. So we looked at the numbers, and we said, hey, we've got something here. Our numbers are better.
Right.
It's a relative of fish. It's a natural product. It's a matter of choosing which one is right.
So, well, end of story.
Well, yeah, you would think so. you know, science is messy. It's messy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people say, well, why can't you get it straight all the time? And the answer is science is messy. It's not straight. It's kind of like the weather in Wisconsin. You can't tell what's coming up next, except in general ways. So it was a meta-analysis from the Archives of Internal Medicine. So these are statisticians who took studies, 14 randomized studies, 20,000 patients. They looked at the studies that were really good, and they didn't look at the numbers, the cholesterol numbers. We know they're better. They looked at who had heart disease and who was more likely to get a heart attack. And they found absolutely no difference in the fish oil group from all these studies combined together and the group that didn't have fish oil. Okay, so, and I've discussed this before. So what happens is they don't find any difference in that. So the changes in cholesterol are cosmetic. In other words, they're superficial, but they don't mean there's a change in what they're doing.
We have a couple of steps here. Fish oil to cholesterol to heart disease.
You got it. That's exactly
it. There are problems in that link between cholesterol and heart disease as well.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, when we look at heart disease, it is a constellation. It's diet. The Mediterranean diet is awesome. It's exercise. We have become a nation of slugs. It's how much we weigh. It's whether we smoke. All these things add into heart disease, and it's not just fish oil. So when I've said this study shows for the most part, and that's for the most part, fish oil really doesn't do much except cosmetically change your cholesterol. Now, the editorial accompanying it said, well, we didn't go out far enough. Well, maybe we should go out 10 years, or maybe we should go out 15 years, or maybe we should go out 20 years. Yeah. Maybe that's not really long. Maybe we ought to go out 30 years. Well, you know, those studies are few and far between.
Yeah.
I think fish is the answer. And once we start to take something out of Mother Nature and we say, this is it, we're often wrong. It's not this. It's this plus that. There must be something else in fish that is useful. So I recommend spending money on good fish and not taking the fish oil.
Well, our dog, Cooper, says he has less pain when he takes his fish
oil. Oh, now that's interesting. Now that's interesting because there's some studies that may show that fish oil helps with arthritis. So you give Cooper a capsule a day. What do you do with it?
Four a day.
How many milligrams? Big capsules.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, you put it in his food or you plop it into his mouth?
I hide it in his food so he's gobbling the food and doesn't know whether he's taking the fish oil.
Now, Cooper.
He'll spit it out.
Cooper will eat anything, right?
Pretty much.
See, now I have Izzy, my dog, the poodle. Yeah. And Izzy is French, so he's very picky. I'll give him a treat, and he'll walk around the house, and then he'll spit it out in front of me, telling me it's
Basset,
not good enough.
A Basset will eat anything for as long as that's there. The Basset would kill himself eating if you left enough food around.
See, and the French poodle is very interested in the way they look, and so, you know, they're not going to eat anything that will disturb their beautiful figure, you see, at least my dog.
So you're listening to Calling All Pets. The number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413.
Ah, back in the day.
A listener with us now, Zorba, in West Plains, Missouri. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm 53. I have a extreme low vitamin D deficiency. A year ago, my doctor said that my D level was really low, and he put me on 2,000 units of vitamin D3. And about 2 weeks later, my heart started acting up, and I went back to the clinic and seen another doctor in the same facility. And he thought it was the D3 that was causing my heart to act up. He said he doesn't see this often, but sometimes when you're not used to taking something and then all of a sudden you take a big dose of something, it can cause that to happen.
Now when you say heart is acting up, what do you mean?
My heart started beating really, it was hard. It was a hard beat, but a real slow. It slowed down. So they sent me to a heart doctor, and they did about $7,000 worth of heart tests.
Ooh. Oh, good. Good for the business.
Found nothing wrong with my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of agreed it could have been, but...
I would disagree completely. I don't think there's I don't think there's any evidence that D causes an abnormal heart rhythm. You can have an abnormal heart rhythm, and then it's important to work it up to make sure it's not what we call a bad one. So a Holter is something called a Holter monitor we often do, which measures your heart rhythm for 24 hours a day, or an event monitor. You push the button when you have the funny rhythm. We may do an echocardiogram to look at the valves in the heart. There's a different...
They did all that.
Right. And that's important to rule out significant heart disease that can kill you. And often the symptom of that can be pretty mild, like just an abnormal sensation, palpitations, mm-hmm. Your heart feels funny. So they were right in doing that, because if so, they may jump in with a certain treatment. But I don't think there's any evidence that 2,000 units of vitamin D causes heart problems at all. I don't think there's any. And I would venture to guess that they cannot give you any scientific evidence either. So, I think sometimes people have palpitations, and frankly, we just don't know. How much coffee do you drink?
None. Zero. But I do drink sodies. Uh-huh. I did. I drink a lot of sodies at that time. I was drinking about probably 3 Dr. Peppers a day.
Uh-huh. So caffeine is in Dr. Pepper. So, that can be part of it. So these palpitations, this funny heart rhythm is gone?
Well, I don't have it now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was weird. I did kind of go off of my sugar and my sodas.
Uh-huh.
And I did quit taking the vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month later, I just didn't have it anymore, and I don't have it now.
Yeah, I don't think it's the D.
Now, before Zorba answers that, you're from Missouri. Do people say sodas in Missouri?
Soda.
Soda. Yeah, sodas. But not sodies? Is that just you, or is that people around Missouri?
It's just everybody here, just soda.
Uh-huh.
Everybody just calls it soda.
No, not sody.
No, well, sodies, soda. It's kind of the same thing.
Let's call the whole thing off.
No, let's call the whole thing off. That's very good. Tom is now going to sing that song. I don't think so. vitamin D, big issue. You can get enough D from the milk to prevent rickets if you're a child. And so we put vitamin D in milk many, many years ago. Very, very important for rickets as kids. But as adults, it appears that we can have low levels of vitamin D, and it's probably because we're not in the sun as much as we used to be. Years ago, we cover up too much sun, can be an issue with skin cancer and so on. So we've started to do vitamin D levels, and when they're low now, we supplement with vitamin D to try to get the level up, because it may help with osteoporosis or softening of the bones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So even though you're drinking milk, you may not be able to get it. The capsule might be worthwhile. I think you should revisit it. I think I would take a vitamin D capsule, and hey, if the palpitations restart again, well, then you've got some odd effect for that isn't scientifically shown.
Does it matter how many units?
I would do what you did. I would do 2,000 units of D, and I would not go back to the Dr. Pepper sody.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your call.
We appreciate the call. Thanks. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's hear from a quiet but proud group, the Pronunciation Police. And this week's correction comes from Anne of Pocatello, Idaho, who writes, "I hate to be a stickler for pronunciation, but I'm afraid that I can't help myself. Recently, Zorba, you were talking through a recipe for Cuban black bean soup, and you mentioned needing to puree some of the soup. You pronounce the verb puree as puree.
Versus puree.
The correct French pronunciation, puree.
But I'm not French.
But you've been there often.
I have been there
you
often. That's exact. I should know better. That's right. I have been to France. I should know how to pronounce the French word.
Thank you. The listener goes on, thank you for making note of this pronunciation tip. I love your show. You and Tom are the best.
Oh, how wonderful. And you know what? You pronounced best the right way. Best.
Instead of beast. Does Zorba need to pardon his French? Send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or just post it on Facebook.
In just a moment, we'll be on the phone with Perry Brzezinski in Montana, who has a recipe, a yummy recipe, looks really good to me, Perry's Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo. That's coming up. More of your calls, of course. Some more interesting research to talk about and our medical mythbuster, too. Here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, it is recipe time, so we'll do it. This one really looks delicious. For our recipe, we welcome Lewistown, Montana listener Perry Brzezinski. Perry, hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
This one is for Perry's Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo. How'd you come up with this one?
Well, I looked at trying to spice up my chicken soup that I had been eating for a day or two. And I love shrimp, so I thought I would put the ingredients of gumbo in there, but keep it a soup because I didn't want to make it a stew.
Well, I've looked over the ingredients. This really looks great. Do you do a lot of cooking?
I do. I love to cook. I used to professionally cook, and I still enjoy myself in the kitchen these days.
Oh, where'd you professionally cook?
Actually, it was at Stevens Point Country Club.
Oh. So
wait a second. Stevens Point Country Club is nowhere near Montana. How'd you get to Montana?
Well, I transplanted myself for a job to work for the state.
Okay, Perry's Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo, dynamite recipe. Start out with four large chicken thighs and then 2 tablespoons. You have 2 tablespoons of chicken soup base. So what do you use?
I use some soup base that comes in a jar.
Jar. Yeah, I find that much better. There's no comparison between that and Weiler's Chicken Bouillon, which is basically chicken-flavored salt. This is what I think it is. Half cup of diced onions. So what kind of onions do you use?
You know, it really doesn't matter. Typically, I just have a yellow onion.
Okay, just a yellow one. A couple of cups of carrots that you use. And then some chopped celery, a cup of chopped celery. A tablespoonful of thyme, and that's dry thyme that you use?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Cup of rice. What kind of rice do you use in this recipe?
Well, I typically have basmati rice laying around my house.
Yeah, I find that so much
what
better.
What is that?
What is that? Well, it's a rice, which is a longer grain rice. Mm-hmm. It costs more money, and it has a different texture, kind of in a different taste. The typical rice you get in a store, we'll say if you get it into a regular grocery store, is really the short grain rice. And it holds up differently. It has a different texture. It has more... it doesn't mush together, if you would, as a short-grain rice. 3/4 of a pound of shrimp peeled and deveined. So you go through the process of taking the shrimp, peeling. Do you actually devein the shrimp, or do you buy it deveined?
These days, they seem to come deveined.
Yes, yeah, and I never bothered. I mean, it doesn't make a difference to me, although some people don't like the look of the veined shrimp. Medium green pepper and a medium red pepper chopped. And tell me about the Anaheim pepper. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it has a little heat to it, but nowhere near the jalapenos. So I like the flavor that it adds to certain dishes, and this being... similar to a Creole type
type
creation.
Pepper.
I like the Anaheim pepper.
Oh, I love peppers. Peppers are, they add the spice to life. Then you've got a half teaspoon of fresh red pepper. So you're talking about the red pepper kind of flakes that you put on a pizza, or do you mean powdered red pepper?
Powdered red pepper.
And cumin, tablespoonful of cumin. Where do you buy your cumin?
I actually get it from a place in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. What place?
Penzies,
great spice place. So let's make it. Okay, so you've got an interesting in phase one and phase two. Peel the skin from the chicken thighs, toss them in a large pot of water, and boil for an hour. So in other words, you're using the skin themselves at all?
You know, if I put, say, a half dozen of the thighs in, mm-hmm. I might leave one or two with the chicken skin on there.
Uh-huh. Okay. But then you take the meat off the thigh. Is that in there? So you take the chicken, you boil it for an hour because then the chicken is now cooked. And then what do? Then you add diced onion, carrots, and celery, and then add the soup base and boil for about 30 minutes with a tablespoonful of thyme and a dash of black pepper. Then debone the chicken thighs if you don't have them already there. Add to the pot a cup of rice and simmer for 30 minutes. And this is phase one. You've got two phases of the study.
Yeah.
And actually, the study, it sounds like, I'm sorry, I'm stuck. You know, once a scientist, always the scientist. This is not a study, it's a recipe.
Well, so, I did major in chemistry for a short time, so my kitchen is a wonder of mixtures.
A wonder of mixtures. So that's the first phase. So in other words, you eat this as a soup? Is that what you do initially?
Oh, yes, chicken mm-hmm. soup, nothing mm-hmm. like it.
So a few days later, so when you've got half the soup left, is that when you do phase two?
Oh, yeah, approximately.
Approximately. You've got half of it left. So then you add chopped red pepper, green peppers. Then you add a diced Anaheim pepper. Add that to the soup. Then you put in the peeled shrimp in a separate pot. Remove it, rinse it, toss the shrimp in, season it with red pepper, and simmer for another 30 minutes and enjoy it.
Sounds delicious.
But, yeah, so it's basically two recipes.
Couldn't I just skip step one and go right to step two and have the finished product
But then you wouldn't have two meals for the week. You know, and Tom, when you cook, don't you cook for a week?
Moving right along.
So you basically have two recipes. By the way, I think this is great. And I love this as a concept for the busy cook. In other words, you're busy, you're in your house, you've got family, mm-hmm. or you're working, and you make one dish, and then you know, I'll eat the dish for leftovers the next day, but I find by day number three, I don't want to have that dish.
Yeah.
So the idea of using that dish as a base for something else, so you're taking initially chicken soup, and then you're making it into shrimp gumbo the next day.
Yeah, it really is a good idea.
It really is a good idea, and I kind of like this as a concept. And I've never seen a cookbook that is sort of a two-phase cookbook. Use this for day one and day two, and then turn your leftovers into something else. But I think you've got a great idea.
There you go, Perry. You could come up with a lot more recipes like this.
That's right.
Put them in a book.
And put in a book, have a cookbook, and you could make $1 million.
Yeah, there aren't enough cookbooks around.
No, they're not. They're very few. That's right.
I agree.
This is a great idea. And we joke there are not enough cookbooks around, but the fact is I buy cookbooks. I buy them around holiday season. Sorry, first. There is competition out there. Phase one, phase two, Perry's Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo. Folks will love it. I'm sure they're going to write for it. And you've got a cookbook idea that you should try.
I should. I do have a couple of variations that I could add to this.
You know, you ought to send it. We'll put it on our website. I think it is a fabulous idea. And we'll put it on our website because that's where we'll talk about where people can get this. People, if they want to get this, can go to zorbapastry.org or they can find us through Facebook. They can find this recipe, other recipes. And Perry, will you give us those additional things? If so, we'll put it on our website.
I shall do that. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you
Thanks
so much.
A lot.
That's zorbapastry.org. Find it. You'll love it. And Perry's Phase 1, Phase 2, Chicken and Shrimp Gumbo.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. To Faribault, Minnesota we go now. Hello.
Hello, Tom and Dr. Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
If I was a teenager in the innocent 50s And starting in the 60s, we've seen a huge increase in drug use across our society. And I'm not talking about aspirins. Now we are seeing the legalization of marijuana. This will result in even more people using, and it's inhaled for the most part like cigarettes. My question is, what are the public health consequences of the increased use? And secondly, is there any medical use for marijuana that is unique to it?
Well, a couple of things about it. First of all, putting the politics to the side, which is impossible. Yeah. Medical use of marijuana, for some people it is very useful. People with HIV/AIDS take a toke, especially if they suffer from anorexia and they can eat. And a lot of them don't like the inebriation, so they choose medical marijuana in those states where it's legal, that is the least inebriating, and it can help their appetite.
Glaucoma?
Glaucoma is one of the uses that they talk about, although frankly, eye drops for glaucoma are much more effective. Some people find it useful for pain, their pain syndromes. Some people find it useful for nausea. Some people find it useful for all sorts of things. A lot of people take marijuana, medical marijuana. I am sure take medical marijuana because they want to be inebriated, and I'm not against that at all. I mean, I have a drink or two, and I have alcohol, and I may feel relaxed when I have alcohol, and I put pot in the same category as that. Now, what's the downside? Well, the downside is you're inhaling a particle, and you're inhaling a particle that has, that's if you're not taking it orally, a particle that is incomplete combustion. So you've got carbon monoxide. And so if you smoke a joint a day, but you'd be really off if you smoked a joint a day, it's probably like a cigarette in terms of its risk. But for most part, when people take marijuana, they're having a toke or two tokes. So it might be like half a cigarette. Is there a risk? There's no evidence that there really has been cancer that's caused by it, probably because it's a minimal risk. But I think the risk, if people get stoned every day, might be the same as being around passive smoke. It really hasn't been studied. The real risk, there are two real risks. Number one, if you're inebriated all the time, you withdraw from life, and I think you become dumb. I don't think it makes you dumb. You just are stoned all the time, so you're not interacting with life, and so you develop a more passive attitude. And for some people, that's what they want in their life. It certainly isn't what I want to live, but it's not my thing. And as for whether or not more of our young people will actually become hooked on drugs, I think myself, and I've looked at the literature, that it's pretty much a myth. If we look at the drug of choice, it's alcohol. The drug of choice for teenagers, for young adults, and for society is alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. And when we try to get rid of that, we ended up getting the mafia that then sold alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. So I am 100% for complete legalization, tax it just like you would. I think that's an important first step. And then you could get rid of the jails and improve money for our school system. So you can see where I stand. But I'm only a doctor and a voter, so that's my thoughts.
Well, thanks for your input on this subject. I'm sure that it's going to be debated for a long time.
Oh, yes, yes. And your fear about that young people will become more inebriated, I think, is a real fear. But it's to me, it fits into the same realm of alcohol. And that's where education begins at home, ends at home, monitoring your children. If there's alcoholism in the family or drug abuse, taking that child at a very early age and treating them. And that turns out to be a big issue. How do we get rid of, the 10 to 15% who have alcoholism or chronic drug abuse? And that's a big issue. And if we look at drug abuse in this country of deaths, if we look at its prescription drugs, and there are more deaths from prescription drugs than cocaine and heroin combined. So we have lots of issues with drug abuse, and marijuana is way down the pipeline. Thanks for your input.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's tackle a rather sensitive question from a concerned listener. Dear Dr. Zorba, very recently, my longtime boyfriend has begun to experience a somewhat troubling issue in the bedroom. He has always had very intense orgasms. Lately, directly after intercourse, he'll often black out and usually awaken completely exhausted and unable to stand. Is this something we should be concerned about?
Well, there's something with the answer is yes, there's a concern because obviously an orgasm is a pleasurable thing, and blacking out and being unable to stand is not pleasurable. Mm-hmm. There are a number of migraine variants that are caused by orgasm. And this may be a migraine variant. I don't know for sure, but it could be a migraine variant. Neurologist, family doc, internist can answer that question.
What does that mean, migraine?
Well, in other words, there's certain things that bring on migraine headaches. And migraine headaches can result in, literally, it can be like a seizure. It can look like a loss in consciousness, appear to be a loss in consciousness. It can have an aura just like a migraine, and mm-hmm. it can have an intense headache that occurs. And it happens with orgasm. It's a known variation of a migraine headache, and there are treatments that you can use for it. There are medications that are anti-inflammatory medications that may work, such as indomethacin. Mm-hmm. Even over-the-counter ibuprofen may work on board prior to sex, an hour or two prior to sex may work. And then sometimes there actually are anti-epileptic drugs that are used, such as gabapentin, which is a drug that's used for chronic pain that will actually nip it in the bud, as well as taking an anti-migraine headache medication. But this may be a migraine variation for this. And the real issue is that kind of interferes with your lifestyle.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you can't have sex and have an orgasm.
This isn't very common.
Well, it's not rare. It's not rare. I don't know how common it is. It's not rare. I don't know what the number is, but it's not a rare event. In my practice, I've had a couple of patients who have had this, who I then got in a neurological evaluation because I want to know if anything else is going on. And they both have ended up with migraine variants. So I think, yes, you ought to get him to a physician, make a full evaluation whether this is a migraine variation, because you know what? When you're blacking out after you're having an orgasm, that can definitely interfere with your sex life.
Indeed. Are you seeking an answer to a curious question? Just send your concern along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And remember, we are all over Facebook.
We have an interesting topic to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, our medical MythBuster 2, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, we talk about some light things, some heavy things. This really is a very controversial a topic which I'm kind of concerned about based on this study.
Well, you know, the right to die and the right to take your own life is always a controversial topic. And,
yes.
you can go to the store and buy a gun, shoot yourself. That's awful and messy, and you can hang yourself. Suicide, by the way, is you're twice as likely to kill yourself in America than you are to be murdered. So it turns out to be a big issue. But this was... It was very interesting because it was a Dutch society where they've had euthanasia, the ability for a physician to terminate a life for many years, for more than 10 years. But in the Netherlands, when you get this, the request has to be voluntary. In other words, the person has to be with it enough to say, I want to do it. It's not with an Alzheimer's patient because it's not voluntary then. It has to be, quote, well thought out. I don't know how they define that, well thought out, but it must not be today. It must be over time. But the patient also has to be suffering unbearably with no prospect of improvement.
Yeah.
So we're talking about people who have terminal cancer,
right,
for the most part, who want to end their lives. And this is a society issue we've grappled with. You know, if you look at Kevorkian, he brought the issue up, and he did a lot of harm, I think, to the whole discussion.
But what we're talking about here is not that.
is not that. We're talking about people who are just tired of living. And should they be allowed to actually get a pill to end their lives? And what I found quite interesting, because they looked at Dutch adults, they looked at physicians, and a surprising number of people agreed. And there were about 2,000 respondents, about almost 60% agreed that they should have right to euthanasia and to determine their own whether or not they should be allowed to take pills to cause their own death. However, only one in four agreed with the vignette in which a doctor helped an elderly patient who was tired of dying. But still, it was one in four.
Tired of living,
wanted to die. So, I mean, still, that was a very, very small number. But one in four is not like 10% or 5%.
So where are you on this?
Well, I wouldn't help somebody if they wanted to take a pill, if they want to go and get a pill themselves. If they had terminal cancer and they had no prospect of living, I'm on the side of thinking if they can go and buy a gun, they should be allowed to take pills themselves. I wouldn't give them the pills, and I wouldn't administer.
This is not terminally ill. I'm tired of living.
I don't think that's a good idea. I think it's a bad idea. I would fit squarely on the side of that is not a good idea, because that is such a slippery slope. I mean, I'm tired of living. I don't want to live. A lot of that is depression and other things that are going on. I would say no. But for somebody with terminal cancer, it should be their right.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller, is a listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I'm doing okay, except for one thing. I'm blind.
Oh.
I've been blind since 1994. I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa in 1975.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I've been trying to look for some kind of medical cure or something. Mm-hmm. And uh-huh. I listened to the Zorba and I listened to you, Tom. I was just wondering if is there any breakthroughs of any kind?
Mm-hmm.
I was told there's a breakthrough in Cuba, but I don't have the money or anything like that, the means to get to Cuba. So it's a dilemma that's been weighing on me for years.
Oh, yes, I bet it has. There, as far as I know, there is no cure. I wouldn't spend money even if I could go to Cuba, because when you hear about things like that, for the most part, they're charlatans and quacks who just want to take your money. If there were a cure for retinitis pigmentosa in Cuba and there was research that showed it, you better believe that in America that would actually be taken up by a lot of people, because they would like to be able to cure this disease. And it's so difficult. How old were you when you finally became blind?
I was 29. I had 20/400 vision.
Mm-hmm.
3 years prior to that, they took my driver's license away when I was 25.
Uh-huh.
I spoke to a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
About 10 years ago, and he said this thing called SMN or MSN, or it's a herbal drug or something.
Mm-hmm. MSN is an herbal drug.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and he said that it rebuilds cartilage. That mm-hmm. the retina is a cartilage.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, the retina is not a cartilage. It's a very unique organ in our body, but it's not
okay.
It's not cartilage. It's a unique organ. There's nothing like the retina anywhere else in the body. It's really neuro tissue. It's really neurological tissue. It's not cartilage at all.
But he said it might rebuild the retina.
Mm-hmm. So did you take it at all?
Because there were so many different side effects.
Uh-huh.
There was just too many odds against it.
Sure, of course.
You know, and so I didn't even try it.
Uh-huh. Well, let me ask something else. So you've got how do you follow up with this? Do you have an ophthalmologist who you see at all or anywhere?
I see a doctor once a year.
Once a year, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the best way to keep up with any new event that is there. You want to see an ophthalmologist who specializes in retinitis pigmentosa, who
okay.
may be abreast of the latest scientific literature for something like this, because there's always hope that technology is going to have some cure for this. And the biggest technology that might have a cure for this would be something such as stem cell technology, where we can actually put a gene back into your body, which would then rebuild the retina. And, you know, right now there's nothing like that out there, but there is a ton of research going on. So don't give up hope. But at this time, I would save my money and not go to Cuba. And there's no nutritional supplement that I know that actually will cure this devastating disease. So there's hope for the future. Hope for the future.
I hope so.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your story with us.
1-800-462-7413, toll free, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, time now for our medical mythbuster. This one comes to us from Daryl in Racine, Wisconsin. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, a few days ago, I was enjoying my lunch at the office break room. Don't worry, Zorba, it was heart healthy. On this particular day, I happened to witness a coworker of mine drop her microwave burrito on the break room floor, splat. She quickly scooped up the burrito and returned it to her plate. When she noticed a few other lunchers looking at her, she quickly declared, 'It's okay, 5-second rule.'"
That's right.
"I've heard people use this phrase before, implying any bacteria on the floor would not have time to adhere to the dropped food, making it safe to eat. Is this in fact the case, or did my coworker just unknowingly boost her immune system?"
She just unknowingly boosted her immune system. There's no 5-second rule at all. I mean, that's what we say, 5-second rule, pick it up and eat it, because we don't want to waste the food. That's exactly what it is.
And you don't want to clean it off.
The bacteria are on the floor. They're going to pop onto the food and go into your stomach. Please, it's a total myth. And I do it too. I'll say, "Oh, 5-second rule, put it in my mouth," because, you know, for the most part, hey, they're, you know, most of the bacteria that are on the floor just kind of, they're not going to bother you. I don't think I would do that in the women's washroom.
No, I wouldn't. I don't think I'd do it with a bunch of people hanging around looking at me.
I wouldn't. Yeah, that's exactly it. You got it, Tom.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to sink his teeth into? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
800-462-7413, toll free, and a Madison, Wisconsin caller here now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I want to say hi to both of you. I've listened to you for a long time, and thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
For some time now, I have been wondering about what vitamins we really are needed to keep us healthy. I've been taking a lot of them over the years, and I wonder if I'm wasting some of my money or some of them that might certainly wouldn't be needed. And I thought I'd call Dr. Zorba and see how, what information he could give us.
Oh, yes. Well, I'll tell you, there's recent research that came out in the Annals of Internal Medicine and an editorial that was associated with it. And these are three long-term studies looking at vitamins, looking at vitamin E, looking at beta-carotene, looking at a multivitamin. And I've recommended for years a multivitamin. You know, I said they're cheap, it's inexpensive, it's $15 a year if you buy a good
multivitamin. Not much science behind that, is there?
Well, it turns out the science behind it is zero.
Yeah.
Pretty much zero. Yeah. And when I say pretty much, I mean greater than 95%, 98%. And so, and I've been concluding this because I write a medical column, and I've just been crafting the medical column of the fact that I've been wasting my money taking a multivitamin too.
And you're going to keep on doing it.
Well, I don't know. I'm out of my multivitamins. So now it's put up or shut up, you know. Am I going to walk the walk or talk the talk? It's that kind of a thing. I think the jury is still out on vitamin D. For a long time, I believed in folic acid. I believed in beta carotene. It's kind of like a religion. These were false gods. I believed in fish oil. I believed in a whole bunch of things. And now there's one goddess who I worship, and that is the goddess of Mother Nature. And vitamins, we've got to look at the history, were really because of certain diseases that happened because we were on the sea, so we got scurvy. We took corn, and we ate a lot of corn and nothing else, so we got pellagra. We got rickets because it was industrialization and children weren't outside, and so we started to believe we could industrialize our health. And now I realize that vitamins are industrial health. That's what they are. They're industrial health. So I have not taken my multivitamin. It's really hard. I haven't taken it for a month now. I really used to love it because I liked the way it looked and it made me feel good. But I'm still taking vitamin D. So right now I think the jury is out on D. And I think the jury is in greater than 95% that multivitamins don't do anything.
What about if your diet isn't
That's our challenge, isn't it? It turns out good health isn't easy. That's what it turns out. Good health takes work, just like exercise. What if you don't like to exercise? Well, then you don't exercise and you run a risk of all the stuff for not exercising. Good health is the same way. If you want to be healthy, you have to eat right. And does that take some work? Yeah. Fruits and vegetables, Mediterranean diet is hands down the best diet to prevent heart disease. The study that came out in New England Journal in March of this year showed hands down it was the best diet. The American Heart Association low-fat diet, hardly anyone sticks to. So I think that should be tossed out.
Well, thank you so much for your information.
You're welcome. Eat well, lots of fruits and vegetables, handful of nuts every day, and I'm not going to buy my vitamin. I guess I've made my commitment now.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
And before we head out today, Zorba, let's dive into another round of Rapid Fire, where Zorba quickly tackles listener questions from our inbox and Facebook page. Are you ready, Zorba?
I am ready.
First up, Judy K. asks, when is the best time to take your supplements, before or after you eat?
It doesn't really make a difference if you're taking your supplements before or after you eat, but the real question is, should you take your supplements?
And the answer is?
I don't think so.
Another fish oil question. Does fish oil help prevent dry eye issues?
Well, I don't think there's any evidence it does that at all, but eating 2 servings of fish a week will keep you alive longer, and therefore, your eyes will be open longer.
Now on to Anne, who asks, I have a mild deficiency in vitamin D. Given our climate, how much vitamin D should we take daily?
2,000 units a day, and I'm still pro-D, so take it. Cheap, inexpensive, and great.
Now Janice W. would like to know if there are certain foods to eat to help avoid kidney stones.
No, not at all. Sorry. Hydrate yourself, especially in the summer. I had a kidney stone, and I can tell you one thing, it wasn't fun.
And finally, now a question for me. Deborah P. asks, Tom, are you from Footville, Wisconsin, and did you paint Now is the Winter of Our Discontent on the hardware store's screen door?
And the answer
I've got to
is...
say, that kind of sounds like me. But I'm not from Footville. And I think if you're going to do graffiti, that isn't bad graffiti. If you have a healthy living question for the good doctor, just post it to our Facebook page or send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or Facebook, or simply go to your local hardware store and put it on with graffiti and send us a photo.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And remember, just come on to Facebook. We're there, too.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Bowtown Philly Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Hammertime Colburn. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0125Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.